Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm David Knowles, and this is a special episode of Ukraine, the latest.
Bravery takes you through the most unimaginable hardships to finally reward you with victory.
If we give President Zelensky the tools, the Ukrainians will finish the job. Slava Ukraini!
Nobody's going to break us. We're strong. We're Ukrainians.
Recently, I spoke to a group of Ukrainian frontline medics. They were in London on a visit to spread awareness of their work and make the case for further aid. I wanted to hear about their experiences on the front lines. What's changed for them over the course of the full-scale invasion, and the realities of being a medic in an army fighting a total war as Western aid falters. Here's our conversation. Thank you so much for coming in. It's a pleasure and an honour to meet you all. Let's go around the table and just introduce ourselves.
Hello, thank you for having me. My name is Brandon Mitchell. I come from Canada, and I serve in Hospitallers Medical Battalion, serving the Ukrainian army since beginning of full-scale invasion.
Good morning. My name is Yuri Soroka. I'm a critical care nurse. I'm working as a medic with MOAS Ukraine team, evacuating critically injured Ukrainian soldiers from the front line.
Hello, my name is Irina Knezhnik. I am a combat medic of a volunteer medical battalion, Hospitaliers, and I have been in that battalion from since 2019.
Brandon, let's start with you. Why did you get involved? And what is your work? What do you do day to day when you're out at the front line?
I was very moved when the war began. It became an obsession on television, social media, and purely out of emotion. I was in a transition period of life, which made it easy. I decided I would go and help, perhaps as a humanitarian worker, but there was an opportunity to serve in a combat medical battalion, and life had a path. I followed it.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what that means when you're working on the front line? What does a combat medical battalion do?
Our battalion, Hospitalieri, has been around for many years, since 2014. We will send teams to assist in various medical capacities, from the zero line to what we have is called medical stabilization points. And now, as our resources have increased, we are able to even place specialist doctors in hospitals to fill gaps in military medicine for all the brigades of the Ukrainian army.
Yuri, is your work similar to that? What do you do exactly?
It is similar. So by trade, I'm a critical care nurse. At the time of the full-scale invasion, I was actually in the United States working in the hospital. But I'm Ukrainian-American. I have family. And part of my family were in harm's way. Their house got shelled and burned down near Kyiv. So when the full-scale invasion of Russia started, we lost all sleep. We couldn't eat. I slept 2 hours a day, probably, still going to work. And I immediately started to think, what am I going to do? I went quickly through the combat medicine training on top of my civilian medical training and was looking for an opportunity to find a team like my colleagues to join and help the injured people in Ukraine. And I was able to find MOAS, which is a nonprofit based in Malta. And they graciously allowed me to join their team with other medics and doctors since 2022. That's what we've been doing.
And Irina, can you give us a sense of what you do and how that might differ from our other guests?
Yeah, my work was quite similar, as Brandon said already, but very often depends on the kind of type of unit I'm working with. It can be company medics or can be battalion medics, but I'm working as close to the front line as possible, and my job to evacuate wounded soldiers from battlefield.
When we talk about the front line, could you give our listeners even the vaguest sense of what that means? What does that look like when you're there?
It's quite dangerous, I must say, because you never know when shelling can begin. So you never know what happened next time, so everything can happen. You never know when casualties can appear. But you are constantly waiting. You are constantly on so to say, combat card alert. We're used to it, so it's not so dangerous for us. I can't say we're not afraid, of course. I am afraid. It is very scary thing sometimes can be. But still, it's just like your job. We're just doing the things we have to do. We are helping people to escape from the hell.
Does it feel like a job or a vocation? How do you approach it when you're out in the field?
Brandon here. For me personally, it's a way of life. It's certainly not for the pay. I'm just very concerned about my friends. The people I don't know, I don't have the capacity to care for, but I want to do a good job. Sometimes I have been in positions, it depends by the terrain. Everything is terrain. Different area of Donbass is much different to Kherson. Sometimes, rarely, maybe 300 meters from the Russian positions. Many times, a couple kilometers back, mostly. But I know many people, and I want them to be... That's my main concern. I want to do a good job for the doctor I work for, that I bring them to. And this is my primary concern for our equipage, we call the team, that they are okay. And Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if you will. And then I will worry outward.
Yuri, this sounds trite. I don't mean it to be, but what would you expect to see in a normal day? What would be a bad day? What would be a good day for you?
So most of the time what we see are critically injured patients, soldiers and civilians. We encounter both. And how they look, usually you're there on your watch and you get a call that in 30 minutes you will receive a patient with such and such injuries and you're getting ready. When they come to us, they're usually covered in blood and dirt. We have to cut the uniforms, basically undress them to find where the injuries are, stop the bleeding, stabilize them. If we need to transfuse blood, antibiotics, a certain blood-stopping medicine, everything. It's like an emergency department, but it's a massive trauma day and night, and it's been years. That's how it is different from my civilian emergency department, which you can get a trauma once in a while, and you have all the resources. But over there in Ukraine, you're in some sort of makeshift small clinic, like an abandoned house in the basement somewhere, and there is dirt. There's no sterile, of course, environment. You're just trying to do the best you can, and you need to stabilize this patient enough to then have him or her to be transported for hours and hours, and you're responsible for the life of that patient. And you're on your own. You don't have much resources out there.
You must have really quite difficult conversations with patients, I imagine, with the soldiers. What do you talk about? What are they asking you? What are you telling them?
You know, sometimes they're keeping very well. Once it was me when a soldier in the vehicle tries with amputation, with high amputation, he tried to keep me me to fall down in the car because, you know, the car is driving very quickly, very bad roads, and he was trying to help me. And sometimes they even joking with us. So I even wrote a post in Facebook with my talks with casualties, because it was a very hard moment. I was working with an infantry and there were a lot of casualties. So it was near Donetsk. And it was really difficult to keep all these things inside. So I need to write it down just to get a relief. So sometimes they just can't ask you, everything, is my leg is done, so it's possible to do something with it. Or don't be worried, I can stand that pain, so don't be so concerned about me. Or look at my colleague, because I'm okay and his wounds are more dangerous. So in my experience, our guys are keeping very well.
Yuri here. I want to add, actually emphasize something. A lot of times when I get wounded, first of all, if they're talking, I'm happy because that means that they're in a pretty decent shape. Secondly, what I see very often in the soldiers we evacuate, they are not concerned of their own health. They are really concerned about their comrades, which they left behind. And they're crying. They're worrying, like, how my guy's going to be there without me? I need to come back. I need to come back. This is a message I see every day. I hear every day.
Brandon here. My qualifications are not so as high as Yuri. As a result, I work in an area where it's much more simple, but for soundbite, maybe perhaps more horrific. Maybe one of the simplest metrics quite often, once the first level of stabilizing a person, to quickly offer out cigarettes, and whoever is smoking wants to smoke. It's more often than not, even anesthesiologists will tell you this, if he wants to smoke, he can wait. And it's that simple.
I can see everybody around the table here is nodding at that. That's an experience.
We have different medical qualifications, but this is across the board.
So when we talk about stabilizing a person, what does that mean in practice? How would you explain that?
Brandon here. First of all, it is the soldier's responsibility or his friend from our zero line to stop the bleeding. My job, only twice in my life have I done first application of tourniquet. But as it's taught in civilian medicine, it is not correct in Ukraine. My responsibility was to drag them down to what we have a root cellar, and then to go get the other, and then to carry on our medicine. But this principle is the same. If you have civilian paramedics, they call it ABC. They go through this algorithm, airways, breathing. Ours is blood first, not airways. But Yuri will do this, we will do this all the way to Dnipro. It's very simple.
When you say blood first, could you explain that? How is it different? What are you dealing with?
Yuri here. So most of the casualties, they're bleeding. And the biggest danger for them in loss of life is that they lose enough blood for their heart to stop beating and their organs to stop being perfused. So the first responsibility of the soldier or his body is to apply some sort of pressure to the source of bleeding to stop it. And then the second thing is to evacuate this patient out of danger so more qualified, healthcare professionals can continue to do what we call damage control and then stabilize and then drive for like hours, for 4 hours to a big hospital with real sterile surgical room where further treatment can be done.
Can I ask, what have you learnt about your jobs? What have you learnt during the time you've been doing this? What's changed for you professionally?
Yuri here. I've learned a big thing, which is different from the Western medicine or even Western combat medicine. We in NATO, we rely on air transportation. A wounded soldier can be evacuated in 15 minutes. In an hour, he'll be in the best hospital in the world. In Ukraine, we don't have air transportation. So sometimes those casualties are sitting there in dirt with tourniquets applied for 12 hours, unable to be evacuated because the Russians are constantly shelling. It's an insecure situation. And this is the biggest challenge for healthcare professionals because the result of this long wait are some irreversible changes, which we are trying to mitigate this mortality and morbidity, but it's very difficult.
Irina, what have you learned in all of your years doing this?
You know, I do not have a medical degree, so I became a combat medic because of war in my country. So when I was a child, I dreamed to be a surgeon. Some strange way my dream come true. The human body is very fragile. It's very easy to hurt it, and very difficult to cure it. So I've learned how to act in so extreme situation, not to be afraid of blood. Be patient with all things which is going around. So... It's a great training for us, I must say, but still, it's better not to be in our life.
Brandon here. I come from a military background years ago, but it's not so relevant, if you understand. I came to Ukraine to help humanitarian and end up in combat medical battalion. It took over the first year, but I realized prevention is more important than anything. And even doctors I work with, of course, I am more successful on social media as a foreigner with English. I only fundraise now for offensive things for our soldiers. This is a painful reality I came to accept. I do not fundraise for medical things. We are all doing this in Ukraine. I'm fundraising for things for our boys because you have to choose between a Russian or a Ukrainian. You don't get to choose both.
We're sitting here, and we met briefly yesterday at the American Embassy, and we were talking before this about how sort of ironic being there in the safest place really in the world behind security doors in the heart of London. What do you know about your friends and your comrades who are on the front line today? Have you been in contact? That must be quite hard for you, really, to know what's going on.
Well, Brandon here again. I was very impressed last night. I want to say this at the embassy. There is so much goodwill. There is power, influence from all circles of life. But, for example, it's very nice, but I'm more concerned about my friend who needs new tires for their evacuation vehicle. I'm more concerned about with volunteers from the UK who help us, or from Sweden in this case today, that my friend Nika, who's medic in 71 Brigade in Avdiivka, you hear of, that we can get her truck. It's very nice what we do yesterday, and it's so important. It's certainly not my priority. Yaroslava needs tires. Nika needs her truck.
Yuri here. As a Ukrainian-American, I have very conflicting feelings these days. Unfortunately, the United States could have done so much more for Ukraine. The shortages of ammo right now are bringing us more and more casualties, and especially in Avdiivka right now, because we're so outgunned by the Russians. And it is a shame that the West and the free world is not providing enough ammo, basically, for these soldiers. And the free world is shrinking, and the Congress is going on vacation. And it's just really sad.
Irina, what do you know of your comrades right now? As we said, we're sort of in London, we're safe.
It was a very weird feeling being here and receiving messages from my friend with a photo of burnt car. Just while we were sitting in the safest place in London, my friends were in danger. Just at the very moment they were evacuating people and their car was burned by Russian FPV drone. And they asked me, can you ask for devices who can cover us from that drones? Because we desperately need it here. Luckily, everybody survived in that car. But still, it was very weird sense. Just we are safe. We are talking about Ukraine. We are talking about the war. And at the same time, the war is still going on and people are dying. And I hate weapons. I'm a combat medic. I saw what damage that things can do to people's body. But I understand that it's impossible to decrease the level of casualty if we cannot eliminate Russian military bases, Russian vehicles. And we have to eliminate the root of the problem. We have to cure not the consequences of the disease, but its reason. I understand this maybe sounds insane from medic, but I think Ukraine needs weapon and ammo first of all, just to kick out Russians out of our territory.
Can I ask you all, what's changed in your jobs over the time you've been doing it? I know you've all been serving at different times. How was it when you started and how is it now? And what changes have you seen during that time?
Brandon, first of all, I will be completely honest, because somebody else in this room admitted the exact same thing to me, so I know it's okay. The first year of the war, the Russians had much more artillery, and it was very random. And when you become used to this, it almost becomes a game, because if it's happening 200 meters away, it don't happen to you. It was more of a game of chance. Because of the vehicles we had, we still use many civilian pattern vehicles. Mitsubishi Pajero is very good, because it's easy to repair. But now, as more aid has come, I've worked on M113, which is very good. Americans on the internet complain, I like it. But as we've had more capabilities for our evacuation, it's also become safer. And I've noticed on medic role, I have been wounded in Soledar. From experience, I spent time in hospital. I blew up in minefield doing evacuation. So I know of this. As we are having more capabilities, on our side, medical is working better, like more logically. We're not taking as many, we take risks, but the risks are getting better. This is purely my experience.
Yuri, what would you add to that?
I want to emphasize that since 2022, we had to expand our operations. So the war is not dwindling. It's actually the conflict is growing. The amount of injuries are at least the same or even bigger. Our MOAS team had a fleet of like probably 25 vehicles in the beginning. Now we had to grow to 50. And our team is 150 people, and we still receive requests from the military to bring more medics, bring more vehicles. Especially, we need 4x4 vehicles. And I want to say something which is going to sound crazy for people in the West, but when Ukrainian soldiers are drafted, their families and their friends are raising money to provide them with transportation, to evacuate them and to take them places, because Ukrainian army does not have enough of these vehicles. And these vehicles are saving lives, especially if they are 4x4 and armored.
Sorry, can I ask just a few more details on that? What do you mean in terms of raising money, like families are buying cars and sending them? Like, how does it work practically?
Thank you, Yuri. So I am from Canada originally. I lived in this country many years in Britain, but I play the Canadian card because the Canadians love it. We have a big neighbour, so we have little man syndrome. I'm sorry, but people are very proud to support a Canadian. Ukrainians are amazing, but many don't have the gift of English. They can only raise hryvnia. So when I'm able to buy cars with donations, for example, I've also worked in Humvee, which are very nice, but I don't know what happens at the higher level, but it seems that America and Kyiv did not make a parts replacement plan, because I work with Marines, 35 Brigade in Kherson, and our brigade had many vehicles compared to 36, but when the Humvee break, we can't fix it. But if it's a Land Cruiser, it costs more money. The army is broke. We are broke. We are fixing everything, but many of us use our pay and our families' pay, and all Ukrainian people will support first their son, and then if they have money left, they will support his friends. This is how Ukrainian collection works.
Is that your experience as well, Irina?
Yes, I donate to my battalion as well, because our battalion is not supported by government. We have only people donation. I donate to my friends sometimes when they say I have needs. I donate to my battalion. We all donate.
Same question to you from earlier, really. What do you think has changed in your job, in your role?
Of course, after the full-scale invasion, things dramatically have changed. Because before that, before the full-scale invasion, I had a 5 rotation to the east. Most of them were under Mariupol, near Mariupol. And the war wasn't so intense. There was a positioning war. We were in trenches, they were in trenches, but they always tried to interfere with evacuations. They always knew because of interceptions, and they always knew we have a casualty, and they always tried to sell the vehicle.
To be clear, you're trying to evacuate wounded soldiers, and the Russians are deliberately.
Yeah, of course, of course. Medics are very desirable target for them. That's what was always so. They never cared about that medics or not medics. I've heard that sometimes they were even awarded. Snipers were awarded if they managed to kill a medic. So we tried not to have insignia, just like ordinary soldiers, without any crest, without any signs that we are medics.
Because the minute you put a cross on you, that's a...
That. And yeah. Snipers were hunting for us, too.
Is that your experience as well?
Yeah, I can second that. And it's getting even worse because with the prevalence of FPV drones, which are very precise weapons, because the operator can actually see where the drone and explosive device is going, targeting evacuation vehicles is a daily occurrence, unfortunately. But it's not surprising because the Russians are sending missiles and rockets into hospitals, clinics, schools. So we should not be surprised. This is a tragedy.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about UnitedHealthcare coverage at UH1.com. That's UH1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow wherever you are. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
You mentioned you don't wear insignia to show that you're a medic. That's almost the opposite thing, isn't it? You want to be like, I'm a healthcare professional, I'm here to help people, but you don't do that.
It doesn't work with Russians.
Is there anything else you can do? Can you take us through what kind of precautions you take? How do you try and minimize the risk for yourselves when you're at zero line?
As I said, from my experience, the war has changed, and I want to be taken serious, but early in the war, as we say in Donbass, Donbim Bombas, it was when a shell would go close to you. It's like you say to your friend, that was a good one. But now with the FPV, and I'm not telling the first-person drone, I'm not telling any secret. I spent 5 months now in Kherson. I left end of December. When we evacuate, we can only do it at night because it's the river. And we have points along this river, hundreds of points, and you never know where you're going. Where we have 300 points in Donbass, they can be longer established. They change. We never know where we're going on the beach, and sometimes we can't even go to our safe places, safer, because it would make a pattern. You never know where you're going. It can only be at night. And the last point I'd finish on this, I don't believe it's just Ukrainian sound bites. I do believe we're smarter than them, because all the innovations are coming out of love from our civilian population, particularly IT. But then Russia copies it, and they make better. Towards the end of November, if you were aware of thermal imaging to see at night, now the Mavic drones that so many people here buy for us, now the FPV drone can see at night. And it's very dangerous in Kherson. The river is safe. No, but on each side of the river, they wait for us. It's the drone. It's not as random as it used to be. In a way, it's much more scary. We can't even go to evacuation points sometimes because of drones. With artillery, this was never... You just take a breath and go.
From what you're saying, it sounds as if drones have been one of the key changes that have changed everything for your jobs. Is that right?
It is correct. We see more soldiers that confirm that they have been injured by the drone. A lot of burns and shrapnel. Basically, it's a hand grenade which is precisely delivered close to your body. Is dead. Is a deadly weapon, and there is thousands of them flying out there every day. And this is what we want to appeal to the West. Russia is getting electronics, even from Great Britain, from United States, from Germany, from France. They are still importing electronics which are used to manufacture these deadly weapons that kill soldiers and civilians. And the Western governments and the people, they can do much more to stop this flow of electronics into Russia so we can eliminate all these casualties and death.
Can I ask you, when you're there and working, how long are you doing that? And how much time do you get off? And how do you spend that time? How do you manage to balance this?
We are volunteers, so it's much easier for us. We are not paid. I'm not paid, for example, but I have freedom. So it's to me to decide how long I will stay there and how long I will stay at home. Usually I took from 1 to 2 months rotations. And then I just, depending on my state, physical state, moral state, I take some pause. But during that break, I'm a military linguist, so I'm working with military as a linguist.
Our team works a little bit differently. Our rotations are 3 months, 24/7, and then you get about 10-day vacation, so it's pretty intense. But our medics and doctors are paid thanks to the generous donations of our donors in the West.
My position, I speak 100, 200 words of Ukrainian or Russian, and sometimes I don't know what word is what. They don't care. Our commanding officer is very pragmatic. There is not many foreigners left in our battalion. And where I work well, I'm free to stay there indefinitely. We know our jobs, but with 2 or 3 English speakers, whether it be driver or doctor. For example, is the commander happy? Are you happy? And the only time I will leave the area, it could be once a month. It could, the longest was 4.5 months, but it was because I fundraise. So I go to Kyiv to get a car or generators. I don't come back empty handed. It's like when you get invited to dinner, you know, it's good form to bring a bottle of wine. So always come back with a generator or a car. That's how I take time off.
To be here and not to be there, how does that feel for you and how do you deal with it?
A little bit guilty. This is my first time I went abroad since the invasion, so I like to travel very much. And it's very weird feelings, really.
When I'm not in Ukraine, I actually have to deal with keeping myself kind of sane and mentally healthy because I'm constantly like waking up, I'm checking how my family, how my friends, how my battalion, how my group. And it's exhausting. But when I'm in Ukraine, when I'm doing my work, when I'm saving lives, that's why I'm happy and I'm more comfortable actually mentally. But of course, it's seeing the injuries is difficult, but medicine is my passion. So, and I like to contribute to my team. I love working with them. So my best time spent saving lives is in Ukraine, actually. And being here and safe, you know, in London, it's kind of surreal.
I don't think I'm addicted to adrenaline or things like this, but I am focused on results. So I was out of Ukraine once before. After Christmas, I've been out. There's many people that want to help us. So it's difficult. I would like to be with my friends, if I'm honest. Life is simpler in Kherson. But I'm very addicted to results. And there's many people, even wealthy people who I've met, of course wealthy people, who are, for example, it will sound like nothing to you, but we use certain medical products. It's called hemostatic gauze, which stops bleeding. And I know the brand that we're getting the result. And if he's willing to buy 10,000 units of this, and for me to spend a day to convince him to buy, I don't want to get in trouble with the brands, but that's a real difference. But people are doing this every day across Europe and the world. I could not do that in Ukraine.
What's your experience talking to people outside of Ukraine about what you do? Have you found it hard to make them understand what it's like? We're having this conversation and it's even, obviously for me, I'm trying to understand what your lives might look like, seeing through your eyes and to bring that to listeners. But what have you found talking to people from outside of Ukraine?
So I'm in the healthcare field and I actually have patients in Ukraine and I have patients in the United States. So I see overwhelming support of the people. And a little bit not understanding like why we people supporting Ukraine, but there's things in the government somehow that all of a sudden the help is delayed. It's always like too little, too late. And now you Ukrainians are dealing with all these casualties. People are thankful. People really support, but they don't understand why the governments in Europe and in the United States and all the world cannot do more to get the Russia out and actually make them pay for what they've done. And there is tons of money sitting in Euroclear, for instance, hundreds of billions of dollars of Russian assets, and they're still not used to not only to rebuild Ukraine, but actually to help the injured people, and actually not only military, but civilians, women, children, elderly. It's just their families who are dealing with all of this tragedy, and we could do so much more.
What about you guys? What's it like talking to people far away from the front lines? How do you do that?
I'm really very happy so many people support Ukraine. And honestly, I was surprised because I know the Russian propaganda is very huge. They're very brilliant in it. Maybe the only thing they really could do brilliantly is propaganda, parallel reality. And I'm so happy that people in civilized world didn't believe that we fascists, that we Russian babies for breakfast and any other bullshit. And not the first war we have with Russia. 100 years ago, we tried, but failed because Ukraine was alone. If I don't mistaken, just Poland and Germany tried to help us, but it wasn't enough. And as a result, for Ukraine, it was a lot of many years of repression, of killed people, of artificial famine. There were 80 millions of Ukrainians at the beginning of the previous century. And at the end, it was about 40. It was a result of Soviet and Russian repressions. They killed people just because they are Ukrainians. So this time, support of Ukraine is huge, and I'm really grateful for this. And I hope this support will continue because we need it urgently.
To talk to people not in Ukraine, I'm a foreigner. There's the media. I must thank you for this podcast every day. And there's different audiences. If I can say yourself and Times Radio, it's an informed audience. This is not the general news. So there is great empathy and search for understanding. I'm also involved with the Ukraine YouTube communities, and there's great amount of goodwill. But the people who know me there, or I'm not as good or as bad as they think. I'm just me. In my personal life, being out of Ukraine now, I don't want people to know me for just a personal anecdote. I lived many happy years in Bournemouth. I used to be an amateur boxer, and my greatest aspiration is to be a coach for kids. I went to a show this week with my old coach in Weymouth, and this is Brandon. He did, and I was like, please, Les, just Brandon. I just want to be, because if they're not Ukraine supporters, I'm a freak. And unless this war spreads to a wider conflict, I rather it not. I rather just be an eccentric freak. But with Ukrainians, I feel, with Donbass Ukrainians, I feel at home.
When you are all looking to the future for the next few months, next year, what do you think are the biggest challenges, the biggest obstacles to doing your job that you think you have to face and you have to overcome?
The biggest obstacle I see is a danger that support will be lower, especially with the United States, with my country. I'm a dual citizen. It is absolutely, you can explain why we would not do it for the security of the United States, why we would not give Ukrainians ammo, the tools to defend their freedom. But if we're not getting the support, if we're low on ammo, we'll be outgunned, we'll have more casualties, we'll lose more territory, and there will be more civilians, women, children suffering from the occupation, invasion, all the injuries and missiles flying. This is going to be even a bigger crisis. So I appeal to the people, so they appeal to their governments to release the funds to give Ukrainians the tools to protect themselves and protect the free world.
I'm also afraid that support will be decreased, and it's really a big danger for us because Russia has a huge resources in people and vehicles. It accumulated a lot of vehicles and ammo since the Soviet Union, since the so-called war, you know, and it's really difficult to fight with such a big enemy alone. And you can be a hero, you can be very well taught, very skillful, but if you run out of ammo and your enemy is not, you are dead. And I don't think it's good for any other countries, because if Russia will win, next will be maybe Moldova, maybe Poland, and maybe Baltic countries. And Russia is an empire. They want to have as much territory as possible, though it looks ridiculous in the 21st century. We have to stop that evil. Otherwise, it will spread this toxic all over the world.
I keep my life simple, but more and more I've noticed, particularly after the summer in the war, I'm very concerned about propaganda and public opinions. And I'm not a scholar, but I know of Germany and Czech. I know of the Sudetenland. And, oh, we will give them that and it will be okay. And, oh, last night, and thank you for hosting this event, but there is very privileged people and a Sandhurst man telling us what peace will be. You know, he's talking about Sudetenland. A repeat of, and do we think we are so enlightened that our human nature has changed in 70, 80 years? I'm so concerned about the propaganda war, and never did I see it to myself until after the summer in Kherson. They are everywhere. I hear on YouTube, oh, there is nothing in, they are crawling, and they are even complacent, the Russians. I see them through drones. We don't have the ammunition to shoot. Give us the tools. Please, give us the tools.
When you go back, can you give our listeners an idea of what the first things you'll be doing when you go back to the front lines, when you get back to your positions?
I'll be doing my usual job. I just be waiting and hoping nothing bad will happen with my unit. You know, I have a white cloud, so just I'm a very, very lucky person from the point of view. So usually when I come to the position, the amount of the casualty is starting gradually decrease. So I will be just doing my job.
Yeah, we're small people, you know, little piece in the puzzle. We'll be back to saving lives, hopefully bringing more equipment, more medicine. It's a constant process of learning or trying to improve your outcomes. I'm looking into the day when we hear from our allies, from the Western world, like from the free world, that, hey, guys, here's your medicine, here's your ammo. Fight for your freedom, fight for our freedom. And there'll be the day which will actually boost the morale of our soldiers, and we will see that the casualties decreasing. We are freeing the land. We're freeing the people who are under occupation and suffering. That's what I'm looking for.
I will not go back to Ukraine for some months. I was very fortunate to live in Sweden before the war, and now, with the help of organizations and Ukrainian Army Medical, I will be going to a lot of hospitals. I come from no medical background, but they really want to help, and I'm going to try to help with the medical aid, that the logistics is done better, that they understand this belongs here, this belongs there. We're already having some successes. It's not so glamorous, but I like the result. But I will go back to Ukraine, and I will join the Marines. I will join Morska Pechota, and I will go back to Kherson. This is my heart.
My final question really is, we speak a lot about Western countries, NATO countries, training Ukrainian soldiers, giving ammunition and weapons, as we've discussed. What would you want to teach Western medical brigades? What have you learned that you think they should know?
No, as I already said, I am a military linguist, so I've been working with instructors, military instructors, who already is teaching Ukrainian soldiers. And many of them says that they are learning from us, just from our experience. So they are already learning from us, because this war is not the same war as it was people used to it. So we have a lot of experience accumulated that we can share with other people. And that people understand now military. I mean, they understand that we can share a lot of experience with them.
My message to my colleagues and to the military in the West is very simple. You don't want to have a war right now with Russia, with China, with Iran. That's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of losses. You don't want to deal with that. We Ukrainians want to fight for you because we have no choice. Give us the tools, give us the ammo, give us the medicine, give us the trucks, the ambulances, and we will do it for you. We will protect the free world. We have no choice. If we are not equipped, if we are not armed, if we don't have enough ammo, every Ukrainian soldier will lose. It's a British or American soldier lost tomorrow. Stop it. Give us the tools. Give us the ammo. We're going to fight for you.
I served in your army, a Canadian army, and I served in the British army in the past, and I was a young boy. But one of my best friends, he is a senior NCO in 2nd Battalion Royal Regiment of Scotland. He is training the Ukrainian soldiers now. I am sending him pictures of Russian trenches, our trench systems. And I see this in NATO videos. They're not digging. The best preventative medicine in Ukraine is called a shovel. All our special forces, all our regular soldiers, all our medics, you dig. And I see this in the videos. The NATO soldiers are training the same as when I was in the army. We have this thing called artillery. And now it's not the Taliban, I'm sorry. You will die. And I'm sent, this is the best thing I can do to my friend, to send him what a Russian blindage, a trench, looks like, what our trenches look like. And to be quite honest, I think we could dig deeper. Russians dig very good.
Is there anything we haven't spoken about that you want to talk about, or that you think our listeners should hear and understand?
Please, we're at the point now. We are not going to get many more Ukraine supporters in the public. There's millions of people around the world, but we are a true minority. When I talk about not only Ukrainians, but foreigners who support every day, they share on their social media. They donate money, particularly to grassroots causes. They've educated themselves, not helping the Red Cross and saying, I've done my job to get a tax write-off, but to really educate themselves. I would encourage you, when you talk to your friends, do it out of empathy. They do not understand, just as you did not understand. By explaining through empathy, you will learn a friend.
I want to thank the British people for their support. We walked through London. We saw the American flags. It means a lot. We want our soldiers and actually civilians who are suffering, we want to see that support. It's boosting their morale. It's important for them to know they are not alone. With the visual support, with flags and rallies. But of course, we need to get the ammo. We need to get the medicine. Thank you.
Irina, would you like the very, very final words?
Maybe I want to say that the war is the most disgusting thing in the world. And it's absolutely unnormal, absolutely ridiculous, if I can use this word. It is happening now in 21st century. It's nonsense, absolutely. I don't understand why they need this war. They have a lot of territory. They do not need Ukraine in territory. They will not become more wealthy if they have got Crimea or Donbass or something like that. We live in such a not very perfect world, of course, still. But you have a lot of possibilities here. If you want to live in Ukraine, you can live in Ukraine. If you want to live in Great Britain, you can live in Great Britain. You can get any education you want. Most people can do this. So I don't know why they are doing this. It's absolutely a ridiculous thing. So I just want to say that it's not normal, and I think that we have to stop this. I hope this war will be the last one in our world, at least for centuries.
Irina, Yuri, and Brandon, thank you so much for your time.
Ukraine the Latest is an original podcast from The Telegraph. To stay on top of all of our Ukraine news, analysis and dispatches from the ground, subscribe to The Telegraph. You can get your first 3 months for just £1 at www.telegraph.co.uk/Ukraine the Latest. Or sign up to Dispatches, our Ukraine newsletter, which brings stories from our award-winning foreign correspondents straight to your inbox. We also have a Ukraine live blog on our website, where you can follow updates as they come in throughout the day, including insights from regular contributors to this podcast. You can listen to this conversation live at 1 p.m. London time each weekday on Twitter Spaces. Follow The Telegraph on Twitter so you don't miss it. To our listeners on YouTube, please note that due to issues beyond our control, there is sometimes a delay between broadcast and upload. So if you want to hear Ukraine the Latest as soon as it is released, do refer to the podcast apps. If you appreciated this podcast, please consider following Ukraine the Latest on your preferred podcast app. And if you have a moment, leave a review, as it helps others find the show. You can also get in touch directly to ask questions or give comments by emailing ukrainepod@telegraph.co.uk. We do read every message. And you can contact us directly on Twitter. You can find our Twitter handles in the description for this episode. As ever, we are especially interested to hear where you are listening from around the world. Ukraine the Latest was produced by Rachel Porter, and the executive producers are David Knowles and Louisa Wells.